Later in the show, Tapper turned to Trump Jr. and asked him to respond to Mook's charge. Trump's son lit into Mook. Well, it just goes to show you their exact moral compass. I mean, they will say anything to be able to win this. I mean, this is time and time again, lie after lie. There's nothing wrong with a fair fight, Jake. I don't mind a fair fight, but these lies and the perpetuating of that kind of nonsense to try, you know, gain some political capital is just outrageous, and he should be ashamed of himself. Manafort took a similar line that morning on another show. He insisted Mook's assertions about the Russians were pure obfuscation on the part of the Clinton campaign. Asked if there were any ties between Trump, Manafort, the campaign, and Putin's regime, Manafort replied, "That's absurd, and you know there's no basis for it." By now, both Trump Jr. and Manafort had good reason to believe the Russians were keenly interested in helping the Trump campaign. Both men, along with Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, had met the previous month at Trump Tower with a delegation from Moscow they were told would have official documents incriminating Hillary Clinton. Manafort had also been emailed about the contacts that Papadopoulos had with Russian cutouts trying to arrange a meeting between Putin and Trump. And Manafort had his own Russian to deal with. He was trying to placate Oleg Deripaska, the billionaire oligarch tight with Putin, who was pursuing him in a legal action in the Cayman Islands for an accounting of the millions of dollars they had jointly invested in the ill-fated Ukrainian cable deal. 3 weeks earlier, Manafort had emailed his Russian business associate, Konstantin Kilimnik, with an idea about how to hold Deripaska at bay. Offer to provide him inside information about the Trump campaign. If he needs private briefings, we can accommodate. He emailed Kilimnik on July 7th. The material dumped by WikiLeaks did not show a vast DNC conspiracy to undercut Sanders that the media coverage suggested. Yet the brush was so dry, it took only a few emails to set it ablaze, and the fire ignited quickly. The anger among Sanders supporters, on Twitter, in the media, and in hotel lobbies in Philadelphia, was red hot. Many demanded Wasserman Schultz and the rest of the DNC senior staff be fired. Mook and other Clinton aides quickly realized and feared the convention could be overwhelmed by this conflict and the ensuing chaos. For them, the hacked DNC emails posed an existential threat. On Saturday, July 23rd, 2 days before the convention would open, Mook had several conversations with Wasserman Schultz. It was time for her to go, he told her. Long before the WikiLeaks dump, Clinton's top advisors had not been satisfied with her leadership of the DNC, nor had White House officials. Now the Clinton team worried that the convention could blow up. Yet, as much as Mook pushed Wasserman Schultz to resign, she resisted. She demanded that she first speak to Obama. She did, and he too pushed her. At last, Wasserman Schultz relented and announced she would step down. Longtime Democratic activist Donna Brazile would replace her on an interim basis. Wasserman Schultz was the first direct victim of the Russian information operation. It was not enough to quell the storm. At a breakfast meeting of the Florida State delegation on Monday morning, Wasserman Schultz was booed and heckled by Sanders delegates. The protesters held signs that read, "Email." She had to be whisked away by a squad of police officers. That afternoon, in a cavernous ballroom in the convention center, Sanders delivered a rousing speech. As he hit all the usual themes, end big money politics, restore the middle class, stop trade agreements, continue the revolution, his supporters cheered wildly. But when he declared they must band together to defeat the bigotry of Trump by electing Clinton, Sanders was drowned out by a chorus of boos and anti-Clinton chants. "Not with her," delegates shouted. For Mook and the others, it looked as if the convention could collapse in a flood of acrimony. They feared that hundreds of Sanders delegates, stoked by the released DNC emails, would shout down pro-Clinton speakers during the convention's primetime hours and even hiss and hoot at Clinton during her acceptance speech. To prevent outright open warfare at the convention, the Clinton and Sanders campaigns merged their convention teams, and the Sanders operation went full throttle to persuade, coax, and cajole delegates to not disrupt the proceedings. The first night, Sanders delegates did boo speakers, but Sanders delivered a forceful speech declaring that the best way for his supporters to advance their progressive revolution was to work for Clinton to defeat Trump. And on the second night, Sanders, at the end of the roll call vote, moved to hand Clinton the nomination by acclamation, a gesture of support. Those actions appeared to quiet the possible uprising of Sanders delegates. Bitterness among the Sanders delegates did linger for the rest of the convention, with many of them continuing to cite the hacked emails as evidence their champion had been unfairly obstructed by a corrupt political establishment. But Clinton's coronation proceeded free of any further commotion. The Clinton campaign had survived the initial Russian attack, but Clinton and her advisors assumed there was more to come. They determined that to withstand whatever was next from Moscow, they had to keep the Russian intervention in the spotlight. So one afternoon during the convention, Jennifer Palmieri and Jake Sullivan grabbed a golf cart and went on a tour of the television network's operations, which were set up in big air-conditioned tents in the parking lots of the Wells Fargo Center. Their mission was to convince the execs, editors, and anchors that they should devote more attention to the Russian intervention. Palmieri was a veteran political operative who had served in the White House and had two decades of experience working with political reporters. She knew them all. Sullivan was a national security expert who had been a top deputy to Clinton at the State Department. He had also been a lead negotiator for the Obama White House in the talks that yielded the Iran nuclear deal. At CNN, they sat down with network chief Jeff Zucker and several correspondents. At Fox News, Brett Baer was part of the session. There was a big group of execs and reporters at the meeting with NBC and MSNBC. At each stop, Sullivan and Palmieri presented the case that the Russians were covertly attacking the election. They noted that intelligence community officials were telling reporters on background, not for public attribution, that Russian intelligence had pulled off the DNC hack. The pair walked the journalists through Trump's past links to Russia. They pointed to the GOP's platform shift on Ukraine. They detailed the Manafort ties. Sullivan explained how Moscow had conducted active measures in the past. This was, Sullivan and Palmieri insisted, a national security issue. The response, Sullivan later said, generally was, "That's interesting," and they looked at us like we were wearing tinfoil hats. Palmieri recalled it this way. The reaction was, "Okay, now tell us about the emails." As she later put it, "We did not succeed." Sullivan and Palmieri realized that the campaign's reaction to the dumped emails, "We're not going to discuss the contents of stolen material and we're blaming the Russians," did not sit well with reporters, nor did it sit well with the Sanders delegates, many of whom, like reporters, were still keenly focused on the content of the emails, not where they came from. When that Russia argument was being made, Nomiki Konst, a Sanders campaign surrogate and delegate, later said, "It just reinforced that nobody wanted to take responsibility. The Clinton campaign had it ingrained in them not to take responsibility, but to deflect." When Mook went on television and claimed Moscow had hacked the DNC to influence the election and benefit Trump, White House officials cringed. They knew the public evidence indicated Russian intelligence was to blame for the DNC breach, and the initial confidential reports from the intelligence community, often called the IC by people within it, confirmed this. But Mook's statement posed a problem, because Obama and the administration were not willing at this stage to publicly back up the Clinton camp's assertion. Weeks earlier, The White House had instructed the IC to find out who or what was behind the DNC hack and the Guccifer 2.0 leaks. The preliminary judgments had come in, yet there was still no firm official consensus within the IC. Often, different intelligence agencies would reach varying conclusions or establish different levels of confidence in a conclusion on such matters, and it would take time and perhaps more information to iron out the differences. By now, Obama was intensely concerned the Russians were messing with the presidential race. "We were worried, given the Russian history of meddling in elections," McDonough, Obama's White House chief of staff, recalled. "There was no misunderstanding in the White House on Putin's view of the West. We were not surprised at a Russian intention to screw with elections around the world." In the years since Putin had returned to the presidency in 2012, McDonough had later remarked, "The White House had watched Russia demonstrate a greater willingness to push the envelope when it came to confronting the United States, and it alarmed us." But Obama didn't want to get ahead of the intelligence community. He told his aides that the White House had to take its lead from the intelligence agencies on this politically sensitive matter. Otherwise, the administration could be accused of playing politics with national security. Everyone knew whom Obama was supporting in the race, and Obama realized how easy it would be for Trump to claim the White House was exploiting or faking intelligence to help Clinton, were he to lean too far into this controversy. "We could never get in front of the IC," a senior White House official later explained. "We would be accused of doctoring the intel and politicizing it to affect an election." Consequently, when Obama was first publicly queried about the WikiLeaks dump and any Russian link, he tried to help Clinton as much as he could without placing the U.S. government's seal of approval on the campaign's Russian accusations. Asked by NBC News' Savannah Guthrie if Russia was trying to interfere, Obama replied that the FBI was still investigating, but added that experts have attributed this to the Russians. He continued, "What I do know is that Donald Trump has repeatedly expressed admiration for Vladimir Putin." When pressed on whether Putin would try to influence the 2016 presidential campaign, Obama remarked, "Anything's possible." This frustrated the Clinton campaign. Couldn't Obama, the campaign's best asset, tell the nation what was happening? Without the U.S. government blaming the Russians for the hacks and the document dumps, Clinton and her aides were out on a limb. Their statements could be easily dismissed as desperate political spin or unfounded hysteria, or both. Democrats on the Hill also wanted more out of Obama. If the Russians were targeting their presidential candidate, they believed voters needed to know. On the third day of the convention, Representative Adam Schiff and Senator Dianne Feinstein, the top-ranking Democrats on the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, sent Obama a public letter noting that if Moscow had engineered the WikiLeaks dump, the episode would represent an unprecedented attempt to meddle in American domestic politics, one that would demand a response by the United States. They asked Obama to consider declassifying and releasing intelligence assessments regarding the incident, including any that might illuminate potential Russian motivations for what would be an unprecedented interference in a U.S. presidential race. Their letter didn't prompt the Obama White House to do anything different. The next day, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest stuck to a careful script. "I just don't want to say anything that could be perceived even as having some kind of influence over the course of that FBI investigation of the DNC hack. I recognize there's been an analysis done that has indicated that the Russians are likely to blame, but that is not a conclusion that the FBI has chosen to publicize at this point." Once again, Clinton campaign officials were exasperated. In their view, the White House was not helping. About this time, the FBI received a startling message that had been passed from the Australian government. Papadopoulos, back in May, had told its top diplomat in Britain the Russian government had dirt on Clinton. In the wake of the WikiLeaks dump, this information seemed ominous, and it was the latest indication for the FBI that it might be necessary to investigate the relationship between Trump's campaign and the Russians. The Bureau already had in its possession the initial Steele memo, with its harrowing allegation of a Trump-Moscow conspiracy. And Page's trip in early July to the Russian capital was suspicious. The hack of the DNC and the subsequent releases by Guccifer 2.0 and DC Leaks, both deemed to be Russian intelligence fronts, was another piece. Then there was Manafort. The Ukrainian government had recently asked the Bureau for help in tracking payments to Manafort from the pro-Russia Party of Regions. The FBI also had received intelligence from friendly spy services, including the Dutch and the British, about contacts between Trump associates and Russia. Comey's FBI made a fateful decision. It launched a counterintelligence investigation into possible links between the Trump campaign and the government of Vladimir Putin. This would be one of the Bureau's most highly guarded secrets. Even while the Bureau was beginning its probe, the U.S. intelligence community was slow to come around to the enormity of what was happening. The fact that the Russians had apparently decided to release, or weaponize, the documents it had stolen was an escalation that made the DNC hack much different from what had happened when the Chinese penetrated the computers of the Obama and McCain campaigns in 2008. But the significance of this was not immediately grasped at the highest levels of the IC. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper was speaking the week of the Democratic Convention at the Aspen Security Forum, an annual conference at which the country's top current and former national security officials appeared. To the surprise of many in the audience, Clapper seemed dismissive of the importance of the DNC hack. "No one should be hyperventilating," Clapper said. He then added sarcastically, "I'm shocked somebody did some hacking. That's never happened before." Clapper was even nonplussed about the idea Russia was seeking to disrupt the election, saying that this isn't terribly different than what went on in the heyday of the Cold War. Clapper's comments found a receptive audience in Moscow. RT, the Russian-controlled English-language media outlet, embraced Clapper's skepticism, publishing a story headlined, "U.S. Intel Head Calls for End to Hyperventilation Over Russia's Alleged Role in DNC Hack." The top U.S. intelligence official had just doused the Clinton campaign's claims with cold water and helped Moscow's top propaganda shop. Unlike the White House, Trump was not reluctant to say what he thought about the Russian allegations. On the first day of the Democratic Convention, Trump weighed in on the Clinton team's effort to make the WikiLeaks dump about Russia and him. He tweeted, "The new joke in town is that Russia leaked the disastrous DNC emails, which should never have been written, stupid, because Putin likes me." On ABC's This Week, he denied having any relationship with Putin. He did not mention his recent attempt to develop a tower project in Moscow with the approval of Putin's government. And Trump said his campaign had nothing to do with softening the Republican Party platform on arming Ukraine. On Meet the Press, Manafort also denied any campaign involvement in that platform fight. They each were dissembling. Speaking at a press conference in Doral, Florida on July 27th, Trump made one of the most remarkable statements of his entire campaign. He doubted the Russians had hacked the Democrats, he said. "Nobody knows who it is," he told reporters. But if it had been the Russians, he had a message for them about the deleted Hillary Clinton emails. "I will tell you this. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you'll probably be rewarded mightily by our press." For months, the media and the Democrats had been speculating whether there was any behind-the-scenes connection between Trump and Russia. But here was a clear and unmistakable message from Trump to the Kremlin. Trump had just invited a foreign adversary to hack his political rival. Chapter 14. We've been told to stand down. In mid-February 2015, General Alexander Bortnikov, director of Russia's FSB, showed up in Washington uninvited. Without consulting the Obama administration, the Kremlin had selected Bortnikov to serve as chief of a Russian delegation to the White House summit on countering violent extremism. This was awkward. The White House had planned the gathering as a high-profile event that would highlight global cooperation to combat the spread of radical jihadi propaganda. But Bortnikov's presence was not what administration officials had in mind. 7 months earlier, the European Union had blacklisted the FSB director, sanctioning him for his role in the Kremlin decision-making that led to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. EU officials were livid and complained to U.S. officials they had been sandbagged. They were being asked to exchange policy ideas with a man they had labeled an international pariah. Nobody wanted him there, Ned Price, NSC communications director, recalled. In the middle of this dispute, CIA Director John Brennan took the unusual step of inviting Bortnikov to visit him in his office on the 7th floor of CIA headquarters. As difficult as it was to have the chief of Russia's secret police at a White House summit, many of the agency's Russia hands believed it was even more unseemly to welcome him to the CIA. "We have to be really careful about the message being sent," Steve Hall, the director of the CIA's Russia House, told Brennan.
Yeah, I get all that," Brennan replied. "But we deal with a lot of nasty people around the world."
Brennan thought it was useful to stay in contact with Bortnikov because he was particularly close to Putin. Brennan had cleared the invitation with the White House. He and Obama wanted to press the FSB chief for help in dealing with the Syrian crisis and counterterrorism efforts against the Islamic State. Hall, who had met Bortnikov during his days as CIA station chief in Moscow a few years earlier, greeted the FSB chief at the CIA's entrance and escorted him into the main hallway, where they met Brennan. Hall didn't relish the assignment. In Brennan's office, both spy chiefs stuck to their standard talking points. Brennan won no new commitments from Bortnikov, but Hall, who sat in on the session, sensed a certain smugness on Bortnikov's part.
"I'm sure he expected people like Steve Hall to be saying, 'Don't have this mobster in your office,'" Hall recalled. He realized, just by sitting in that office, he'd already won.
More than a year later, on August 4, 2016, Brennan was on the phone with Bortnikov for a regularly scheduled call, with the main subject once more the war in Syria. By this point, Brennan had had it with the Russian spy chief. Brennan's pleas for help in defusing the Syrian crisis had gotten nowhere. And after they finished discussing Syria, again with no progress, Brennan addressed two other issues not on the official agenda. First, Brennan raised Russia's continued harassment of U.S. diplomats, an especially sensitive matter at Langley after the undercover CIA officer was beaten outside the U.S. Embassy in Moscow 2 months earlier. The continued mistreatment of U.S. diplomats, Brennan told Bortnikov, was irresponsible, reckless, intolerable, and needed to stop. And, he pointedly noted, it was Bortnikov's own FSB that has been most responsible for this outrageous behavior. Then, Brennan turned to an even more sensitive issue, Russia's interference in the American election. Brennan now was aware that a few months after he had welcomed Bortnikov to the CIA, Russian hackers had begun their cyber attack on the Democratic National Committee. "We know you're doing this," Brennan said to the Russian. He pointed out that Americans would be enraged to find out Moscow was seeking to subvert the election and that such an operation could backfire. Brennan warned Bortnikov that if Russia continued this information warfare, there would be a price to pay.
he did not specify the consequences. Bortnikov, as Brennan expected, denied Russia was doing anything to influence the election. This was, he groused, Washington yet again scapegoating Moscow. Brennan repeated his warning. Once more, Bortnikov claimed there was no Russian meddling, but, he added, he would inform Putin of Brennan's comments. This was the first of several warnings that the Obama administration would send to Moscow, but the question of how aggressively to respond would soon divide the White House staff, pitting the National Security Council's top analysts for Russia and cyber issues against senior policymakers within the administration. At the end of July, it had become obvious to Brennan that the Russians were mounting an aggressive and wide-ranging effort to interfere in the election. He was also seeing intelligence about contacts and interactions between Russian officials and Americans involved in the Trump campaign. By now, several European intelligence services had reported to the CIA that Russian operatives were reaching out to people within Trump's circle. Brennan wondered whether Moscow had the cooperation of anyone within Trump's camp. Brennan spoke with Comey and Admiral Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA, and asked them to dispatch to the CIA their experts to form a working group at Langley that would review the intelligence and figure out the full scope and nature of the Russian operation. Brennan was thinking about the lessons of the 9/11 attack. Al-Qaeda had been able to pull off that operation partly because U.S. intelligence agencies, several of which had collected bits of intelligence regarding the plotters before the attack, had not shared the material within the intelligence community. Brennan wanted a process in which NSA, FBI, and CIA experts could freely share with each other the information each agency had on the Russian operation, even the most sensitive information that tended not to be disseminated throughout the full intelligence community. Brennan realized this was what he would later call an exceptionally, exceptionally sensitive issue. Here was an active counterintelligence case, already begun by the FBI, aiming at uncovering and stopping Russian covert activity in the middle of a U.S. presidential campaign. And it included digging into whether it involved Americans in contact with Russia. While Brennan wrangled the intelligence agencies into a turf-crossing operation that could feed the White House information on the Russian operation, Obama convened a series of meetings to devise a plan for responding to and countering whatever the Russians were up to. The meetings followed the procedure known in the federal government as the interagency process. The general routine is for the deputy chiefs of the relevant government agencies to meet and hammer out options for the principals, that is, the heads of the agencies, and then the principals hold a separate and sometimes parallel chain of meetings to discuss and perhaps debate before presenting choices to the president. But for this topic, the protocols were not routine. Usually, when the White House invited the deputies and principals to such meetings, they informed them of the subject at hand and provided read-ahead memos outlining what was on the agenda. This time, the agency officials just received instructions to show up at the White House at a certain time. No reason given, no memos supplied. We were only told that a meeting was scheduled and our principal or deputy was expected to attend, recalled a senior administration official who participated in the sessions. At the State Department, only a small number of officials were cleared to receive the most sensitive information on the Russian hack. The group included John Kerry, Tony Blinken, the Deputy Secretary of State, Dan Smith, head of the department's intelligence bureau, and John Finer, Kerry's chief of staff. For the usual interagency sessions, principals and deputies could bring staffers. Not this time. There were no plus ones, an attendee recalled. When the subject of a principal's or deputy's meeting was a national security matter, the gathering was often held in the Situation Room of the White House. The in-house video feed of the sit room, without audio, would be available to national security officials at the White House and elsewhere, and these officials could at least see that a meeting was in progress and who was attending. For the meetings related to the Russian hack, Susan Rice ordered the video feed turned off. She did not want others in the national security establishment to know what was underway, fearing leaks from within the bureaucracy. Rice would chair the principal's meeting, which brought together Brennan, Clapper, Comey, Kerry, Defense Secretary Ash Carter, Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, and General Joseph Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with only a few other White House officials present, including Dennis McDonough, Lisa Monaco, Obama's Homeland Security Advisor, and Colin Kahl, Joe Biden's National Security Advisor. Kahl had to insist to Rice that he be allowed to attend so Biden could be kept up to speed. Rice's number two, Deputy National Security Advisor Avril Haines, oversaw the deputies' sessions. White House officials not in the meetings in general were not told what was being discussed. This even included other NSC staffers, some of whom bristled at being cut out. Often, the intelligence material covered in these meetings was not placed in the president's daily brief, the top-secret document presented to the president every morning. Too many people had access to the PDB. The OPSEC on this, the operational security, was as tight as it could be, one White House official later said. As the interagency process began, there was no question on the big picture being drawn up by the analysts and experts assembled by Brennan. Russian state-sponsored hackers were behind the cyber attacks and the release of the swiped material. They knew who the cutouts were, one participant later said. There was not a lot of doubt. It was not immediately clear, however, how far and wide within the Russian government the effort ran. Was it coming from one or two Russian outfits operating on their own, or was it being directed from the top and part of a larger project? The intelligence at this point was also unclear on a central point, Moscow's primary aim. Was it to sow discord and chaos to delegitimize the U.S. election? Prompting a political crisis in the United States was certainly in keeping with Putin's overall goal of weakening Western governments. There was another obvious reason for the Russian assault. Putin despised Hillary Clinton, blaming her for the domestic protests that followed the 2011 Russian legislative elections marred by fraud. U.S. officials saw the Russian operation as designed at least to weaken Clinton during the election, not necessarily prevent her from winning. After all, the Russians were as susceptible as any political observers to the conventional wisdom that she was likely to beat Trump. If Clinton, after a chaotic election, staggered across the finish line, bruised and battered, she might well be a damaged president and less able to challenge Putin. And there was a third possible reason: to help Trump. Did the Russians believe they could influence a national election in the United States and affect the results? At this stage, the intelligence community analysts and officials working on this issue considered this point not yet fully substantiated by the intelligence they possessed. Given Trump's business dealings with Russians over the years and his positive remarks about Putin, there seemed ample cause for Putin to desire Trump in the White House. The intelligence experts did believe this could be part of the mix for Moscow. Why not shoot for the moon and see if we can get Trump elected? All these potential motives were not mutually exclusive, a top Obama aide later said. Obama would be vacationing in Martha's Vineyard until August 21st, and the deputies took his return as an informal deadline for preparing a list of options: sanctions, diplomatic responses, and cyber counterattacks that could be put in front of the principals and the president. As these deliberations were underway, more troubling intelligence got reported to the White House. Russian-linked hackers were probing the computers of state election systems, particularly voter registration databases. The first reports to the FBI came from Illinois. In late June, its voter database was targeted in a persistent cyber attack that lasted for weeks. The attackers were using several foreign IP addresses. They were relentlessly pinging the database, 5 times per second, 24 hours a day, and they succeeded in accessing data on up to 200,000 Illinois voters. Then, there was a similar report from Arizona, where the username and password of a county election official was stolen. The state was forced to shut down its voter registration system for a week. Then in Florida, another attack. One NSC staffer regularly walked into the office of Michael Daniel, the White House Director of Cybersecurity, with disturbing updates. "Michael," he would say, "5 more states got popped. Or 4. Or 3. At one point, Daniel took a deep breath and told him, "It's starting to look like every single state has been targeted." "I don't think anybody knew what to make of it," Jay Johnson later said. The states selected seemed to be random. His Department of Homeland Security could see no logic to it. If the goal was simply to instigate confusion on election day, Johnson figured, whoever was doing this could simply call in a bomb threat. Other administration officials had a darker view and believed that the Russians were deliberately plotting digital manipulations, perhaps with the goal of altering results. Michael Daniel was alarmed. He believed the Russians' ability to fiddle with the national vote count and swing a national U.S. election to a desired candidate seemed limited, if not impossible. "We have 3,000 jurisdictions," Daniel subsequently explained. "You have to pick the county where the race was going to be tight and manipulate the results. That seemed beyond their reach. The Russians were not trying to flip votes. To have that level of precision was not feasible." But Daniel was focused on another parade of horribles. If hackers could penetrate a state election voter database, they might be able to delete every 10th name, or flip 2 digits in a voter's ID number, so when a voter showed up at the polls, his or her name would not match. The changes could be subtle, not easily discerned. But the potential for disorder on election day was immense. The Russians would only have to cause problems in a small number of locations. Problems with registration files, vote counting, or other mechanisms, and faith in the overall tally could be questioned. Who knew what would happen then? Daniel even worried that the Russians might post online a video of a hacked voting machine. The video would not have to be real to stoke the paranoids of the world and cause a segment of the electorate to suspect or conclude that the actual results could not be trusted. He envisioned Moscow planning to create multiple disruptions on election day to call the final counts into question. The Russian scans, probes, and penetrations of state voting systems changed the top-secret conversations underway. Administration officials were now worried the Russians were scheming to infiltrate voting systems to disrupt the election or affect tallies on election day. And the consensus among Obama's top advisors was that potential Russian election tampering was far more dangerous. The Russian hack-and-dump campaign, they generally believed, was unlikely to make the difference in the outcome of the presidential election. After all, could Trump really beat Clinton? Yet messing with voting systems could raise questions about the integrity of the election and the results. That was, they believed, the more serious threat. Weeks earlier, Trump had started claiming that the only way he could lose the election would be if it were rigged. With one candidate and his supporters spreading this notion, it would not take many irregularities to spark a full-scale crisis on election day. Obama instructed Johnson to move immediately to shore up the defenses of state election systems. On August 15th, Johnson, while in the basement of his parents' home in upstate New York, held a conference call with secretaries of state and other chief election officials of every state. Without mentioning the Russian cyber intrusions into state systems, he told them there was a need to boost the security of the election infrastructure and offered DHS's assistance. He raised the possibility of designating election systems as critical infrastructure, just like dams and the electrical grid, meaning that a malicious cyber attack could trigger a federal response. Much to Johnson's surprise, this move ran into resistance. Many of the state officials, especially from the red states, wanted little, if anything, to do with the DHS. Leading the charge was Brian Kemp, Georgia's Secretary of State, an ambitious, staunchly conservative Republican who feared the hidden hand of the Obama White House. "We don't need the federal government to take over our voting," he told Johnson. Johnson tried to explain that DHS's cybersecurity experts could help state systems search for vulnerabilities and protect against penetrations. He encouraged them to take basic cybersecurity steps, such as ensuring voting machines were not connected to the internet when voting was underway. And he kept explaining that any federal help would be voluntary for the states. He must have used the word voluntary 15 times, recalled a Homeland Security official who was on the call. But there was a lot of skepticism that revolved around saying, "We don't want Big Brother coming in and running our election process." After the call, Johnson and his aides realized encouraging local officials to accept their help was going to be tough. They gave up on the idea of declaring these systems critical infrastructure and instead concluded they would have to keep urging state and local officials to accept their cybersecurity assistance. Johnson's interaction with local and state officials was a warning for the White House. If administration officials were going to enlist these election officials to thwart Russian interference in the voting, they would need GOP leaders in Congress to be part of the endeavor, and in a way vouch for the federal government. Yet, they had no idea how difficult that would be. At the first principals' meeting, Brennan had serious news for his colleagues. The most recent intelligence indicated that Putin had ordered or was overseeing the Russian cyber operations targeting the U.S. election, and the IC was now certain that the Russian operation entailed more than spy services gathering information. It now viewed the Russian action as a full-scale active measure. This intelligence was so sensitive, it had not been put in the president's daily brief. Brennan had informed Obama personally about this, but he did not want this information circulating throughout the national security system. The other principals were surprised to hear that Putin had a direct hand in the operation and that he would be so bold. It was one thing for Russian intelligence to see what it could get away with. It was quite another for these attacks to be part of a concerted effort from the top of the Kremlin hierarchy. But the secret source in the Kremlin, who 2 years earlier had regularly provided information to an American official in the U.S. Embassy, had warned that a massive operation targeting Western democracies was being planned. The development of the Gerasimov Doctrine was another indication that full-scale information warfare against the United States was a possibility. And there had been an intelligence report in May noting that a GRU officer had bragged of a payback operation that would be Putin's revenge on Clinton. But these few clues had not led to a consensus at senior government levels that a major Putin-led attack was on the way. At this point, Obama's top national security officials were uncertain how to respond. As they would later describe it, any steps they might take, calling out the Russians, imposing sanctions, raising alarms about the penetrations of state systems, could draw greater attention to the issue and maybe even help cause the disorder the Kremlin sought. A high-profile U.S. government reaction, they worried, could amplify the psychological effects of the Russian attack and help Moscow achieve its end. There was a concern if we did too much to spin this up into an Obama-Putin face-off, it would help the Russians achieve their objectives. A participant in the principals' meeting later noted, "It would create chaos, help Trump, and hurt Clinton. We had to figure out how to do this in a way so we wouldn't create an own goal. We had a strong sense of the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm." A parallel concern for them was how the Obama administration could respond to the Russian attack without appearing too partisan. Obama was actively campaigning for Clinton. Would a tough and vocal reaction be seen as a White House attempt to assist Clinton and stick it to Trump? They worried that a White House effort to counter Russian meddling came across as a political maneuver that could compromise the ability of DHS to work with state and local election officials to make sure the voting system was sound. Was Obama too worried about being perceived as prejudicial or conniving? Perhaps there was some overcompensation, a top Obama aide said later. As Obama and his top policymakers saw it, they were stuck with several dilemmas. Inform the public about the Russian attack without triggering widespread unease about the election system. Be proactive without coming across as partisan and bolstering Trump's claim the election was a sham. Prevent Putin from further cyber aggression without prompting him to do more. "This was one of the most complex and challenging issues I dealt with in government," said Avril Haines, the NSC's number two official, who oversaw the deputies' meetings. The principals asked the Treasury Department to craft a list of far-reaching economic sanctions. Officials at the State Department began working up diplomatic penalties, and the White House pushed the IC to develop more intelligence on the Russian operation so Obama and his aides could consider whether to publicly call out Moscow. At this point, a group of NSC officials, committed to a forceful response to Moscow's intervention, started concocting creative options for cyber attacks that would expand the information war Putin had begun. Michael Daniel and Celeste Wallander, the NSC's top Russia analyst, were convinced the United States needed to strike back hard against the Russians and make it clear that Moscow had crossed a red line. Words alone wouldn't do the trick. There had to be consequences. "I wanted to send a signal that we would not tolerate disruptions to our electoral process," Daniel recalled. His basic argument: the Russians are going to push as hard as they can until we start pushing back. Daniel and Wallander began drafting options for more aggressive responses beyond anything the Obama administration or the U.S. government had ever before contemplated in response to a cyber attack. One proposal was to unleash the NSA to mount a series of far-reaching cyber attacks, to dismantle the Guccifer 2.0 and DCLeaks.com websites that had been leaking the emails and memos stolen from Democratic targets, to bombard Russian news sites with a wave of automated traffic in a so-called denial-of-service attack that would shut the news sites down, and to launch an attack on the Russian intelligence agencies themselves, seeking to disrupt their command and control modes. Knowing that Putin was notoriously protective of any information about his family, Wallander also suggested targeting Putin himself. She proposed leaking snippets of classified intelligence to reveal the secret bank accounts in Latvia held for Putin's daughters, a direct poke at the Russian president that would be sure to infuriate him. Wallander also brainstormed ideas with Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs and a fellow hardliner. They drafted other proposals: to dump dirt on Russian websites about Putin's money, about the girlfriends of top Russian officials, about corruption in Putin's United Russia Party, essentially to give Putin a taste of his own medicine. "We wanted to raise the cost in a manner Putin recognized," Nuland recalled. One idea Daniel proposed was unusual. The United States and NATO should publicly announce a giant cyber exercise against a mythical Eurasian country demonstrating that Western nations had it within their power to shut down Russia's entire civil infrastructure and cripple its economy. But Wallander and Daniels' bosses at the White House were not on board. One day in late August, National Security Advisor Susan Rice called Daniel into her office and demanded he cease and desist from working on the cyber options he was developing. "Don't get ahead of us," she warned him. The White House was not prepared to endorse any of these ideas. Daniel and his team in the White House Cyber Response Group were given strict orders. "Stand down." She told Daniel to knock it off, he recalled. Daniel walked back to his office. That was one pissed-off national security advisor, he told one of his aides. At his morning staff meeting, Daniel matter-of-factly said to his team it had to stop work on options to counter the Russian attack. "We've been told to stand down." Daniel Prieto, one of Daniel's top deputies, recalled, "I was incredulous and in disbelief. It took me a moment to process. In my head, I was like, did I hear that correctly?" Then Prieto spoke up, asking, "Why the hell are we standing down? Michael, can you help us understand?" Daniel informed them that the orders came from both Rice and Lisa Monaco, the chief Homeland Security advisor. They were concerned that were the options to leak, it would force Obama to act. They didn't want to box the president in, Prieto subsequently said. It was a critical moment that, as Prieto saw it, scuttled the chance for a forceful, immediate response to the Russian hack, and keenly disappointed the NSC aides who had been developing the options. They were convinced that the president and his top aides didn't get the stakes. There was a disconnect between the urgency felt at the staff level and the views of the president and his senior aides, said Prieto. When senior officials argued that the issue could be revisited after Election Day, Daniel and his staff intensely disagreed. "No, the longer you wait, it diminishes your effectiveness. If you're in a street fight, you have to hit back," Prieto remarked. Obama and his top aides did view the challenge at hand differently than the NSC staffers. "The first order objective directed by President Obama," McDonough recalled, "was to protect the integrity of the election. Confronting Putin was necessary, Obama believed, but not if it risked blowing up the election. He wanted to make sure whatever action was taken would not lead to a political crisis at home, and with Trump, the possibility for that was great. The nation had had more than 200 years of elections and peaceful transitions of power. Obama didn't want that to end on his watch." By now, the principals were into the nitty-gritty, discussing in the sit room the specifics of how to respond. They were not overly concerned about Moscow's influence campaign to shape voter attitudes. The key question was precisely how to thwart further Russian meddling that could undermine the mechanics of the election. Strong sanctions? Other punishments? The principals did discuss cyber responses. The prospect of hitting back with cyber caused trepidation within the deputies' and principals' meetings. The United States was telling Russia this sort of meddling was unacceptable. If Washington engaged in the same type of covert combat, some of the principals believed, Washington's demand would mean nothing, and there could be an escalation in cyber warfare. There were concerns that the U.S. would have more to lose in all-out cyber war. "If we got into a tit-for-tat on cyber with the Russians, it would not be to our advantage," a participant later remarked. "They could do more to damage us in a cyber war or have a greater impact." In one of the meetings, Clapper said that he was worried that Russia might respond with cyber attacks against America's critical infrastructure and possibly shut down the electrical grid. The State Department had worked up its own traditional punishments, booting Russian diplomats and spies out of the United States and shutting down Russian facilities on American soil, and Treasury had drafted a series of economic sanctions that included massive assaults on Putin's economy, such as targeting Russia's military industries and cutting off Russia from the global financial system. One proposal called for imposing the same sorts of sanctions as had been placed on Iran. Any entity that did business with Russian banks would not be allowed to do business with U.S. financial institutions. But the intelligence community warned that if the United States responded with a massive response of any sort, Putin would see it as an attempt at regime change. This could lead to a nuclear escalation, a top Obama aide later said, speaking metaphorically. After 2 weeks or so of deliberations, the White House put these options on hold. Instead, Obama and his aides came up with a different plan. First, DHS would keep trying to work with the state voting systems. For that to succeed, the administration needed buy-in from congressional Republicans. So Obama would reach out to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Paul Ryan to try to deliver a bipartisan and public message that the Russian threat to the election was serious and that local officials should collaborate with the feds to protect the electoral infrastructure. Obama and the principals also decided that the U.S. government would have to issue a public statement calling out Russia for having already secretly messed with the 2016 campaign. But even this seemed a difficult task fraught with potential problems. Obama and his top aides believed that if the president himself issued such a message, Trump and the Republicans would accuse him of exploiting intelligence or making up intelligence to help Clinton. The declaration would have to come from the intelligence community. The IC was instructed to start crafting a statement. In the meantime, Obama would continue to say nothing publicly about the most serious information warfare attack ever launched against the United States. Most of all, Obama and his aides had to figure out how to ensure the Russians ceased their meddling immediately. They came up with an answer that would frustrate the NSC hawks, who believed Obama and his senior advisors were tying themselves in knots and looking for reasons not to act. The president would privately warn Putin and vow overwhelming retaliation for any further intervention in the election. This, they thought, could more likely dissuade Putin than hitting back at this moment. That is, they believed the threat of action would be more effective than actually taking action. A meeting of the G20 was scheduled for the first week in September in China. Obama and Putin would both be attending. Obama, according to this plan, would confront Putin and issue a powerful threat that supposedly would convince Russia to back off. Obama would do so without spelling out for Putin the precise damage he would inflict on Russia. An unspecified threat would be far more potent than Putin knowing what we would do, one of the principals later said. Let his imagination run wild. That would be far more effective, we thought, than freezing this or that person's assets. But the essence of the message would be that if Putin did not stop, the United States would impose sanctions to crater its economy. Obama and his aides were confident the intelligence community could track any new Russian efforts to penetrate the election infrastructure. If the IC detected new attempts, Obama then could quickly slam Russia with sanctions or other retribution. But the principals agreed, for this plan, no action now but possible consequences later, to work, the president had to be ready to pull the trigger. Chapter 15. He's got me as the fall guy. It may have been just a throwaway line, but to former FBI analyst Clint Watts, an offhand comment Paul Manafort made to CNN's Jake Tapper on the morning of August 14th was a sign of something deeply troubling stirring beneath the surface of the 2016 presidential campaign. Manafort was being grilled about Trump's latest off-the-wall comment, a remark at a rally in Wilmington, North Carolina, about how Second Amendment people might have to do something to stop Hillary Clinton's judicial appointments were she to be elected. Was Trump suggesting violence to stop judicial picks? Tapper asked. Not at all, Manafort replied. The fact Tapper was asking at all, he said, was further evidence of news media bias. I mean, there's plenty of news to cover this week that I haven't seen covered, he said.